mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we wrap up some of the cultural trends of 2012 and look ahead to a brand new year in films, books, and video games. From challenges to indie theaters to a new wave of steamy fiction. Plus, cookbook author Kathy Guntz shares her hopes for good eating in 2013. But we begin with a more immediate look at perception and guns. After the Sandy Hook school shooting last month, President Obama and several lawmakers declared gun control to be a legislative priority in 2013. Among proposals being debated are a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and on improving background checks on buyers at retail outlets, gun shows, and even private sales. The NRA countered that the safest solution is to train and install armed guards at every school in the country. While the gun control debate is often framed as an argument over interpreting the Second Amendment, a more controversial discussion is arising in op-eds, on talk radio, and online. Do guns encourage or deter violent behavior? Jessica Witt is Associate Professor of Cognitive Psychology at Colorado State University, and she recently authored a study finding that simply holding a gun changes the way a person perceives the world. Jessica, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello.
Before we talk specifically about guns, can you give us some examples of your work on the link between perception and behavior?
Most of my work to date actually is focused on perception in athletes, so how athletes perceive the world depending on if they're playing better or worse on a given day. So, for example, softball players who are hitting better see the ball as bigger. Golfers who are playing better see the hole as bigger. In contrast, tennis players who are playing better see the net as lower. And the net, unlike the ball or the hole, the net's an obstacle. And so when you're playing better, it actually looks smaller.
So why did you turn your attention to guns?
So far, most of my research has been on spatial properties, such as distance, size or speed, and we wanted to know if these same kinds of effects were apparent in perception of objects. I was thinking about this idea that when you hold a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the implications of the saying relates to whether or not you're holding a gun. So if you're holding a gun, then what does everything look like? And I decided to actually do that study itself.
How'd you conduct the study, and then what did you find?
The way the study worked was that participants were tasked with viewing photographs of people and having to say if the person in the photograph was holding a gun or a neutral object like a wallet or a shoe. And the key manipulation was that the participants were also holding a gun or a neutral object at the time that they made the response. So if they saw a gun in the picture, they were to raise their object and point at the screen. And if they saw a shoe, they were to lower their object and point at the ground.
Mm-hmm.
What we found was that when participants were holding a gun, there was an increased bias to see guns, whether or not a gun was present.
Okay, so more of these subjects perceived the figure to be holding a gun if they themselves were holding a gun. Just want
exactly.
to make sure. Were there any influences by images of race or gender, for example?
We did not look at the effects of gender. All of the people in our photographs were male. We did look at race. So in one of our studies, half the people in the photographs were black and half were white. And we found no additional effects of race, meaning that holding a gun did not influence your perception of guns differently if the person in the photograph was black or white.
I'm curious about reaction time now. Were the subjects who were holding guns more likely to make, I don't know, quicker decisions about whether they perceived a gun or another object?
Yes. So often when people were holding a gun, they were faster to make these responses. But not always. So sometimes we found that people were faster when holding a gun, and sometimes we found that they were the same when they were also holding a ball. What we do find, which is very consistent in the literature, is that people are very fast when they see a gun.
Mm-hmm.
So when they see a gun, they're very quick to respond.
We're talking about research that suggests that the act of holding a firearm actually alters perception. In this case, suspecting that someone else is holding a gun, even if they're not. With us is Jessica Witt from Colorado State University. Well, I'm wondering about, you know, you mentioned the when you hold a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? There's this cause of shifting perception. You're sort of primed for something. Is it that simple? Is there something else going on here, Jessica?
We think that what is crucial to these effects is that there has to be an intention to use the object. So if the object is in your hand and you're using it to make your response, then you get these effects. But if the object is just present in the room, but you have no intention to use it, then there isn't the same bias. And one thing that was especially interesting about that series of studies was that the gun we used in our experiments that participants were holding is actually a white plastic Wii gun.
Mm-hmm.
So it was clearly a toy. It really had no capability of doing anything. Whereas when we put the gun in the room to see if just the presence of a gun would create these effects, that gun was a real gun. It was rendered non-functional, but it looked like a real gun. Mm. And so just the presence of a gun is not enough. You actually have to have this intention to use it.
I wonder what your study might suggest, or the data you came up with might suggest, about putting more guns into the hands of more people, which is, you know, currently the public debate over gun control.
Yeah, well, what our research shows is that if you put more guns in more people's hands, then there are going to be more biases to see guns even when they're not there.
I wonder if you've had any pushback regarding your study by gun rights advocates.
To date, we have not spoken with any gun rights activists. So at this point, no. And I think one thing that's important is that even though we're showing there will be increased bias, for the most part, people who own guns do care about safety. And so from the people that we've talked to, for example, in police departments, they want to know about the risks associated with holding and using a gun. So far, we've actually had a lot of positive response to our work.
Well, Jessica, I want to thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Jessica Witt, Associate Professor of Cognitive Psychology at Colorado State University. Her study, Action Alters Object Identification, Wielding a Gun Increases the Bias to See Guns, was published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology. And you can find links to more on her work on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. In the aftermath of the Sandy Hook school shooting, pundits, lawmakers, and parents pointed to the effect of video game violence on children. While this question has been around since the 1970s, there is no evidence that violent games or other media contributes, even in a small way, to increased aggressive behaviors, decreased pro-social behaviors, or any violence among youth. For gamers, it is an old and tired debate, and the success of the medium continues to rise. In 2011, consumers spent more than $16 billion on video game content. Add hardware and accessories like new consoles and controllers, and that number jumps to $24 billion. Blockbuster titles like Assassin's Creed and Call of Duty and small cult classics produced by indie game makers are still being played on consoles, computers, and smartphones. Clay Wirestone is editor of the Arts and Culture pages at the Concord Monitor and a video game enthusiast, which is why we invited him to be our industry trend watcher for 2013. Clay, great to have you back.
Happy New Year, Virginia.
Happy New Year to you.
Yeah.
Before we can look ahead to 2013, of course, let's break down 2012 a bit. Some of the big trends you saw, starting with consoles like Nintendo and PlayStation, how are they faring?
Well, they're changing. The usual console life cycle is about 5 to 6 years, and the last consoles came out around 2005, 2006, so we're kind of due for a refresh. And Nintendo had its first new console, kind of first out of the gate with the Wii U in November. It kind of married a traditional console with a tablet-style controller that you could input on and maybe occasionally play what was on the TV screen would move to the controller. It looks like Microsoft and Sony may have new consoles come out this year. But, you know, it is a challenging market overall for these kind of old-school video game console makers and publishers because they rely on selling pieces of plastic in big box stores. And you can kind of ask the music industry how that's worked out for them. So, you know, there's a lot of experimentation going on with digital distribution and things like that.
We mentioned that people aren't just playing games on televisions at home, on iPhones, they're playing on Facebook. What happened with mobile gaming in 2012?
Well, it's really one of the major stories of the last 3 or 4 years in the area. You know, everyone is in the space now. It's not just two guys in their garage. It's not just somebody in their basement. You know, major video game publishers like Electronic Arts, Activision, Take-Two, these are all long-established folks. they're selling their games just in the App Store. You can buy Grand Theft Auto 3 now in the iPhone App Store. Mm. You know, the real question is, can they actually make money there? Is that a sustainable business model for them? And, you know, you just have to look at what happened over the last year with Zynga to see a cautionary tale. I mean, that's the company that makes all the Ville games.
Right, Farmville and
Villeville and Theville. And they had an IPO in late 2011. They lost 75% of their value this year, laid off 100 employees, shutting down 11 games. You know, people are just not as interested now in playing that kind of game on Facebook. So was it a fad? Maybe so.
In 2012, we did talk to you. You had just attended PAX East, a huge video game convention, and you were at the time really excited about indie games and games funded through Kickstarter. Did that continue through the rest of the year?
Absolutely. At the time, a longtime adventure game designer, Tim Schafer, had raised $3.3 million for a new project. Since then, an old school RPG studio named Obsidian Entertainment went to Kickstarter, raised $4 million for a project. Some other experienced developers are moving into that space as well. I mean, the real question now is not whether or not people can raise money on a Kickstarter. They clearly can. It's going to be, are the games any good? Are they going to be games that people actually want to play and experience?
I want to go back to this notion of computer games. A lot of people are predicting that this year tablets will overtake laptops as the status quo. So are people still playing on these PC games?
You know, they've never really left, but they're actually stronger than ever. And it's probably because there's so much activity in the indie space right now, independent games. And that's the easiest platform for those folks to publish to. There's really no barrier to entry there. And plus, there's this great platform out there now. It's called Steam. A lot of people who aren't gamers don't know about it, but it's essentially like iTunes for computer games. Mm-hmm. You can download, manage your game library, and launch games from there. And virtually all of the PC gaming space has moved over to this platform. Plus, a lot of PC games now are moving to a free-to-play model. Downloading the game is free. Playing it is free. If you want to like upgrade your characters or get different characters, then you have to pay a little bit of real money.
I wonder about, you know, there's all these different mediums and all these different sort of ways of platforms of delivery. How do you measure the overall success of the industry? I mean, do you know how it's doing right now?
Well, it's kind of the best of times, the worst of times. You know, for mainstream retail game sales, the ones that are in stores, you know, 2011 was down from 2010 by 8%. It looks like 2012 is going to be down probably 10 to 20% from 2011. But on the other hand, some of the big blockbuster games like Call of Duty, Black Ops 2, it did $1 billion worth of business in 15 days over the holiday season. Halo 4 sold 4 million copies over a few weeks. And, you know, and if you add in the mobile game and digital distribution sales, obviously that's healthy as well, although those kind of numbers aren't really released to the public.
Clay, any favorite games of yours from 2012?
Well, I liked a lot of the smaller games. There was a game out for the PS3 called Journey. It was kind of an abstract game in which you were going across a desert towards a mountain, very atmospheric. There's also a game called Little Inferno that was a fireplace simulator, believe it or not, with a very funny backstory and kind of a melancholy tone for the Wii U and the PC. The most acclaimed game of the year, believe it or not, was a point-and-click adventure game based on the Walking Dead TV series.
Yeah, zombies very big.
Well, zombies are very big, but this game, it came out in five different sections. It was $5 a pop. You could play it on the PC. You could play it on your video game console. You could play it on an iPad or an iPhone. So that says a lot.
Okay, so thinking about these games that you've talked about with us in the past, and of course we're reading a lot about this recently at a press conference, a week ago, the NRA Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre blamed violent video games along with music videos and movies for the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. Now, this debate, as I mentioned, has been going on for a long time. Is it going to resurface again, you think?
Well, I mean, obviously folks are talking about it now, but I mean, the industry really tried to address this back in the 90s. I mean, this was a big deal in the mid-90s. Joe Lieberman had hearings in the Senate and stuff, and the industry actually adopted a ratings system, much like the movie ratings. And, you know, if you buy an M-rated game, which is something that has more sex or drugs or whatever in it, violence, you know, you have to show an ID. I mean, I've been carded to buy video games many times. But, you know, on the other hand, there have been reports here recently that some major game manufacturers had actually had agreements with some gun makers to feature their guns in their shooting games to make them extra realistic. And that adds a little bit of gray into the situation, I guess.
Well, Clay, we have just a half a minute left. Any other big trends you think we're going to be seeing in 2013? Motion centers, 3D, you know what?
Smell-o-vision.
Smell-o-vision.
I think you'll see a lot more of those adventure games like the Walking Dead I mentioned earlier. You know, the industry loves to copy success and hopefully improve on it a little bit.
Clay Wirestone, arts editor at the Concord Monitor. You can read more about his favorites for 2012 and his predictions for 2013 at the Word of Mouth Facebook page. And coming up, we're going to take a look at that big screen in 2013. We'll preview some upcoming film trends and maybe some shakeups.
Superman came out in the 30s and was very much a product of the Depression. And every time we see a new reinvention of Superman, it tries to tap into what's going on with our economics.
The 80s, right?
The 80s. So now we're going to see whether or not the new Superman is going to be able to tap into that anger and frustration that's going on with the 99%, the 47%. I keep forgetting which percent we're talking about.
When Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now, ideas worth vetting.
But what if somebody said they could change your brain by touching your head? Well, that's exactly what I'm here to talk about today.
Brain massage, vortex math, and wacky theories about giants are examples of hokey science discussed at locally staged TEDx conferences. TED stands for Technology, Education, and Design, and its motto is Ideas Worth Spreading. Tickets for TED's meticulously produced conferences go for $4,000 to $8,000. TED Talks are then posted online to be viewed by millions of people worldwide. TEDx conferences are locally produced, always free, and presented under strict licensing agreements. Content, however, is up to local teams. Late last month, the TED brass issued a public letter warning TEDx organizers to vet their guests and to be on the lookout for red flag topics or have their licenses revoked. Phil Plait is an astronomer and writer for Slate.com and a TEDx speaker. He's a proponent of scientific skepticism and applauds TED's letter. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
You spoke at a TEDx event in Boulder, Colorado last year. Was your talk vetted?
Yes, it was. But I'm kind of in a different case than usual because I'm a published scientist. I have a very public track record of being careful. I admit my mistakes and correct them. So when somebody like me, who is a scientist, comes on, chances are what's going to be said is something that's maybe a little bit more based in reality. But that's not always the case. And it's not always easy to tell the difference between science and pseudoscience for people who may not be experienced looking at them. So I'm really happy that this guideline was sent out to the TEDx folks. I think it's great.
Well, your talk jumped a rung and it was posted as a TED talk. That sometimes happens, the sort of trickle-up effect of TEDx. But let's go back to that letter. The TEDx organization defined pseudoscience and came up with some guidelines for making sure that speakers and topics are worthy of the TED brand. What did they suggest, Phil?
Well, a lot of it is sort of basic stuff. What history does this person have? Is there a Wikipedia entry on them? That's a good first cut, going to Wikipedia and looking them up. However, anybody can edit Wikipedia, and there are people with different ideas out there. So if somebody is, let me just use the word crackpot, just to really be out there, they might have followers who believe them, and those people might put up a Wikipedia page about them. So you can't rely on that, but it's a good first cut. Look for scientific research this person has done. Have they published in respectable, peer-reviewed scientific journals? Have they given other talks? Are there other people in their field or in other fields who have written about them or said things about them. Now, these aren't necessarily sufficient to change or to separate science from pseudoscience, but as a first step, as a necessary step, I think that's important. And they list a lot of other red flags as well. People making outrageous claims, making claims that don't seem to follow from what they're saying. You know, we can cure cancer by looking at somebody, or just things like that. These are all the sorts of things people should have in mind while they're doing this.
Here's a case of point. TED Talk removed from the TED website, but still available on YouTube. Randy Powell here from a TEDx event in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The saying is that mathematics is the language of God, but until now, no one's been speaking God's language. What we have is the grand unified field theory. With it, you can create inexhaustible free energy, end all diseases, produce unlimited food, travel anywhere in the universe, build the ultimate supercomputer, artificial intelligence, and obsolete all existing technology. How is it possible to make such outrageous claims? Because we have the secret that connects all of the world.
Carl Zimmer, he's been a guest on this program, among those who called that one out. So, Phil, what are the red flags organizers should have noticed about this presentation?
Well, the new agey music may have been a key right away. I've never heard music like that in a TED Talk. But honestly, right away, outrageous claims, way too many, we're gonna fix everything in the universe kind of claims, free energy, cure disease, travel anywhere in the universe. These sorts of things are immediate and very loud alarm bells in my head. Plus, the idea of free energy, that violates one of the most basic laws of physics that we have shown to be true a gazillion times over the past several centuries. So somebody coming up and saying, why with just math we can, you know, sidestep this, really should be making the people vetting it squirm in their seats.
Your TED Talk was called How to Defend the Earth from Asteroids, correct?
Yes.
Okay, at first blush, that could sound a little far out. I mean, is there a risk of TED's new recommendations having a chilling effect on emerging science or radical ideas or new approaches to things worth discussing?
Yes, but that's because it has to be used carefully. Like any tool, it can be used for good or for bad. And in this case, for example, with my talk, we know that asteroids are a threat. We know the dinosaurs were wiped out by asteroids. We know we get hit by them. So looking something like that up is not that hard. And you find astronauts, engineers, scientists, astronomers, NASA taking this issue seriously. So right away, that establishes some credibility for it. On the other hand, if I were saying we need to use a free energy levitation device to raise our consciousness and push asteroids away, that's different. I don't know where I'd rather come down. Would I rather not see something that may be useful pushed away, or would I rather see it praised? The TED folks have to be careful of their brand. Mm. And in that case, they're going to be a little conservative, and they may push away something that might be an interesting line of thinking. However, this isn't just make a decision. This is research that decision. Call people, talk to them. If their brand is that important, then it's important that they do the necessary groundwork to make sure that what they're putting on stage is acceptable. And I don't mind seeing somebody standing up there and saying, here's an interesting line of thought that may not work, but it's something we should be looking into. As long as that sort of caveat is made, I'm fine. It's just that you can't put something up where somebody's talking about violating six different laws of physics before breakfast and just letting him go on and saying how this is completely possible when it's clearly not.
Well, Phil, I want to thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. This was fun.
Phil Plait writes for the Bad Astronomy blog on Slate.com. You can find a link to his article, view some controversial TEDx talks, and share your own thoughts on our Facebook page. TED is, by the way, partnering with NPR on a program called the TED Radio Hour. Rest assured, all the talkers featured on that show have been thoroughly vetted by TED. 2012 was a banner year for big screen comic book adaptations. Marvel's The Avengers was the top-grossing film of the year, followed by the latest in the Batman franchise, The Dark Knight Rises.
You should be as afraid of him as I am.
I won't bury you. I've buried enough members of the Wayne family.
You don't owe these people anymore.
Together, those two films took in over $1 billion in domestic ticket sales. A few smaller budgeted adult-oriented films also made a big splash at the box office. Ben Affleck's Argo, Steven Spielberg's historical drama Lincoln, and the surprisingly deep stripper film Magic Mike all grossed more than $100 million. So now we look ahead to the movie trends gaining steam for 2013. And here to gaze into his crystal ball is film consultant and commentator Garen Daly. Garen, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Virginia.
Welcome. Always great to have you.
My pleasure as always. I love seeing you.
Comic book adaptations again dominated this year. Now, there is a new Superman on tap for 2013. Yep. Can it compete with the Caped Crusader?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, when you start thinking about Superman, Superman came out in the 30s and was very much a product of the Depression. And every time we see a new reinvention of Superman, it tries to tap into what's going on with our economics.
The 80s, right?
The 80s. So now we're going to see whether or not the new Superman is going to be able to tap into that anger and frustration that's going on with the 99%, the 47%. I keep forgetting which percent we're talking about.
Well, I noticed Hunger Games also came in at number three for box office. Most searched for film on Twitter, by the way, of 2012. I noticed some post-apocalyptic films coming up, one starring Tom Cruise, another Will Smith. Anything there?
Well, I think that the post-apocalyptic, or the PA, as we like to say in the business, is something that has been really strong and has been doing very well, not only in movies, but also on TV. And we're starting to see a crossover between the two. You know, Walking Dead's doing very well on TV. All of a sudden, you're going to start seeing some post-apocalyptic zombie films going on out there.
Mm. Let's look at some of the other trends in genre that we can look forward to in 2013. What are you seeing?
I think one of the big ones is animation. And if you take a look at what is going to be nominated or what's in the conversation about animated films, you're looking at 7-8 really good films. And there's a reason for that. One of them is anybody can make an animated film these days, and anybody can dub in the voices for any country. So it becomes
very easy to
be able to make a film and have it play in Russia with Russian voices, America and American voices, and dovetail it. This is not too dissimilar to how the film industry ran itself in the 20s when everything was silent. You just changed the subtitles, and then you created a film for the world.
I hadn't thought of it. Now, here's a clip for one of the most looked forward to, Pixar's Monsters U, that's going to be due out this summer.
Since the very first bedtime, all around the world, children have known there are monsters hiding in their closets. But what they don't know is those monsters weren't always so scary.
Class president?
They had to go to college first.
So kids, again, a reliable market for 2013?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and again, why is it such a reliable market? And there are two reasons. One is parents have to take kids, so you get two people going there. And then when the kids go there, they got to buy concessions. So that's a huge thing. But I always kind of put this into the Rocky and Bullwinkle theme of things. When you remember the Rocky and Bullwinkle show from the 60s, it was very, very successful. But it was successful because it appealed to like three separate groups. For young kids, the animation just drew them in. And for adults, they loved the sly, submersive humor, and they were laughing at it. And the teens, seeing that the other two were in on it, didn't want to be left out. So they got into it too. So it was very successful because of that. And you can apply that to just about every single animated kids film out there. They have to have a smart dialogue to go with the animation and the story to keep the adults satisfied, and then the kids just don't want to be left out.
On the other end of the spectrum, you're looking at senior films as a big trend for 2013.
Let's make no mistake about it. Exotic Marigold Hotel did an enormous amount of business, not only domestically, but internationally. And, you know, you saw a lot of films coming out this year talking about seniors having sex, you know, being action heroes. I love the...
Yeah, I noticed, like, Bruce Willis, Liam Neeson, Sylvester Stallone, they're all still action heroes.
They're still action. And we have Live Hard or Die Hard Again, whichever one of it is. I can't remember. Die Hard 5 is what, and I'm looking forward to it. I love the Die Hard, but think about Skyfall. All right,
right.
A wonderful Bond movie, my favorite Bond movie for just about all time. But there is a budding romance going on between Judi Dench and Albert Finney near the end, which is very, very sweet. But it's also, I think, allows the audience that grew up in the '60s. To connect with the 2012 version of James Bond.
So Hollywood has at least one big zombie flick left up its sleeve.
Here's two, I think.
Okay, so let's hear this, the trailer from World War Z. This is starring Brad Pitt and adapted from the hit book by Max Brooks.
Is it really fast?
No.
Does it live on the Great Plains of Africa?
No. Hey!
What is going on?
Hold on, guys.
Daddy, be careful on the road. Jerry?
Get back in your car right now! Remain with your vehicle!
Big bang.
Big bang. Troubled production. So there's a lot of buzz whether or not they're actually going to be able to pull it up.
What's going on?
Well, they had to go back and do a lot of reshoots, and there are problems with the script, that it didn't make a lot of sense. The trailer looks very, very good, but again, as we know, trailers are trailers. But the one that I think is going to be a key for 2013 is what I'm calling a zom rom-com.
Watch it.
Which is a zombie romance comedy. It's called.
What's funnier than zombies dating?
Well, this is it. Zombies and humans interacting there. That's really what it's about. And it stars Nicholas Hoult, who you may remember as a 10-year-old boy in About a Boy.
Uh-huh.
He's now grown up, and he's now in Warm Bodies, which is about a zombie who falls in love with a human and somehow becomes unzombified.
We've got superhero adaptations. Yeah. We've got PA films, post-apocalypse.
Right. I'm glad you picked up on that.
Animation, senior films, zombie films. Any other significant trends in demographics?
There have been some studies now showing that Hispanics go to the movies more frequently than any other demographic group. Then you look at the fact that it's a burgeoning demographic in the United States as well. And there's a big distinction now going on in Hollywood between those that speak Spanish and those that speak English, because the majority of Hispanics in the United States don't necessarily speak Spanish. So they are making films that employ Spanish-speaking people, but in a English-speaking capacity. Perfect example would be one of the reasons that they're touting that Hotel Transylvania was such a big success was Selena Gomez was one of the voices.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about film trends for 2013 with film consultant and commentator Garen Daly. And I wonder if there's also, with the Hispanic, let's say token Hispanic characters in some cases, are they pitching to the worldwide audience? I mean, you've told us before, that's where the money is.
I think that there is. I mean, again, when you look at Hollywood, even though this year was a very good year domestically for the film industry. The reality is 70% or nearly 70% of the money that they're taking in comes what is known as the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And Argentina is now falling into that. France is now falling into that as well. So the global market is huge, and everything that Hollywood is planning these days with these large films is geared towards the global market. There's a downside to that in the fact that they'll be making plots that are more innocuous and not necessarily idiosyncratic to, say, the United States.
Yeah, I did notice I got my fill of movie trailers over the holiday break and noticed a lot of plots set in Russia. And this is another thing, Garen. Is it my imagination? When we go to the movies now, are we getting a half hour of trailers?
Yes, we are.
Oh, my gosh. I couldn't believe it.
And if you go early enough, they have these little things where they're pushing other things like concession stands.
Exactly. Well, what I have to say is one of the things that made me look around and think, maybe that's why people aren't going to the theaters. They're binge watching at home.
Well, binge viewing is one of those trends that we're going to see more and more of, and that poses questions for advertisers. When people all of a sudden decide that they're going to watch all of Downton Abbey in one weekend, they're going to just skip through all the commercials.
I wouldn't know what you're talking about, Garen. Any other significant trends this year about getting people back into theaters?
Well, the industry is looking at a lot of stuff. I mean, one of the big issues is digital migration and what the impact of that is. This is the new projection systems.
Have to get digital. I know. There's a local theater, Red River Theater, is doing a push to try and buy digital equipment.
A lot of distributors are dropping 35mm completely and have said, if you're not a digital, we're no longer going to service you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's going to impact a lot of small theaters, community-oriented theaters. theaters. The industry estimates that 10,000 or 20% of all screens are going to close.
Oh, my.
And you're already starting to see it in Boston, the Harvard Square closed. A bunch of other places are closing as well. Where this is really going to be impactful is on drive-ins. We may be seeing the death knell for drive-ins because they can no longer afford the $70,000 it costs to put a brand new booth in there.
How are the theaters going to keep people in there? Is there any way to draw them in, bump up those funds?
One of the big new trends, it's not a new trend, but it's expanding, is called Cinema Grill.
So food.
Good food. Not just popcorn, but some high-end food.
With those horrible-looking nachos.
Showcase Cinema has their deluxe where they serve food. Their beer and wine is big. Another thing is you're going to start seeing more theaters do reserve tickets. They're going to install software into their ticket-selling thing where you can actually reserve your seat in advance as if you were going to a play. The idea here is that people are pressed for time, and they're willing to pay the extra premium to be able to say, I can just show up there, I can walk in, I've got my tickets, it's on my smartphone, I can sit where I know I'm going to be sitting, and I don't have to stand in line.
Or watch those trailers,
exactly.
Well, Garen, Happy New Year. We look forward to more conversations with you in 2013.
My pleasure.
Film consultant and commentator Garen Daly there. More entertainment trends coming up. We're going to have a look ahead to the publishing universe, and Chef Kathy Gunst is going to set the table with her predictions for 2013. Books and food. What could possibly be better? That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier in the program, we heard about the growing mobility of video games. An announcement by the Museum of Modern Art signals upward mobility for the genre. MoMA has acquired 14 video games to be installed in its permanent collection in March, placing Pac-Man in an institution better known for Picasso's. Jamin Warren is founder of the video game magazine Killscreen. He helped the project along by creating a short list of games for consideration. We reached him by Skype. Jamin, how did you get involved in this project?
We've had a running relationship for the past couple years. They've been an amazing partner. One of their curatorial assistants purchased a copy of our magazine when we were getting started, and that sparked the dialogue. We were able to meet with Paola Antonelli, who's the senior curator there. And you know, we were very fortunate last year to do a one-night party for about 1,000 people, bringing video games to three of the floors at MoMA, tied to their Talk to Me exhibition. So MoMA's definitely had a conversation with games over the last couple of years, and we're very fortunate to be a part of that.
So it's embracing it on some level, but has been under fire from some corners for elevating the status of video games to art, especially since this announcement. But I do recall a few years ago, Roger Ebert declaring, "Video games will never be art." I'm wondering how MoMA's design curator, Paola Antonelli, you mentioned, how does she defend the acquisition?
Well, I mean, I think for starters, anytime you fall into these very large, wide-reaching definitions about what is or what is not art, you're going to find yourself in a bit of trouble, simply because that definition of art, even amongst people in the art world, is a moving target. So to say that, you know, video games as an entire medium wholesale does not qualify as art, I think is a pretty facile way to think about not just art, but also the nature of games. So I'm happy with MoMA that we've moved past this conversation of whether or not video games are or aren't art, but which games qualify as art, and really highlighting what types of titles are appropriate for a museum setting.
So what they've chosen for titles are 14 games for the permanent collection, eventually going up to 40. Do you have a list in front of you? Can you tell us the 14 games?
Sure. They're Pac-Man, Tetris, Another World, Myst, SimCity 2000, Vibribbon, The Sims, Katamari Damacy, EVE Online, Dwarf Fortress, Portal, Flow, Passage, and Cannibal.
So years beginning 1980, Pac-Man, and then the most recent game, Cannibalt, 2009. What was the criteria for being chosen?
I mean, there are a lot of ways to think about games. And what's exciting is that MoMA defined their own criteria. You find this a lot with museums and other cultural institutions that have an interest in games. They usually just pick things that they think that the public will enjoy or they think is most popular without defining how those games fit into the larger collection. And so I think one of the things that MoMA did wisely is outline basically a set of criteria that you can use to judge all games that will be taken in the MoMA. For different museums, it's going to be different. They fall roughly on four different categories. The first is behavior, described as like mechanics. So what games do, the scenarios, the rules, incentives. Those are the things that designers kind of create from the ground up. The other would be aesthetics, which is just what do games look like. There are two others that are, I think, are a little bit more abstract. One was space, which was the space that was designed not just with the code as brick and mortar, but sort of the temporal existence of the game, kind of where it sits, mm-hmm. what kind of experiences it creates. And then the last one is time, which for anyone who plays iOS games, this is something that's actually become very interesting, I think, for game players, in that you're seeing a lot more games these days play with shorter bursts, shorter sequences that might be akin to the early arcade games. You know, I think what's great about games is that, particularly on the time question, you are making a decision about whether or not you want to engage with a medium, and so deciding how much of your time it's going to take. That's a crucial design choice on the part of game designers.
We're talking about the addition of 14 video games to the Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection, which has proved controversial for the museum. With us is Killscreen founder Jamin Warren, who advised MoMA on the acquisition. It's funny to look at the comments online about this issue. I wonder if there's been more debate over whether these games belong at MoMA or which games were chosen.
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, what you find is the people, like the art critic at The Guardian, who is very critical of MoMA's acquisition, you find that the folks who are saying that games don't belong in museums, I think, you know, in general, they tend to be a lot older or people who didn't grow up on games. And so this seems like sort of a crazy position for the museum to take. But games have grown so much. And I think for anyone who's grown up with games, they understand that the experiences that they're having, those are the same types of experiences that are elicited by other art forms. And so it's natural for them to think that games would be included. What's wonderful, I think, about the acquisition, and I think this is not necessarily true about other types of acquisition. So, you know, the Scream, Edward Munch's The Scream is up at MoMA right now, and you have to go, you can look at images online, but you can't go in person. You obviously have to go in person to see it. And what's great about these selections is that, you know, that the vast majority of these games are available for people to experience in their own homes. And so I think with any popular medium like that, it's very exciting that people can have both the experience of seeing them when the games will be shown in the design gallery next year, but they can also play these experiences at home. I think that's a great way to engage with an art form.
Now, the question about how one acquires a video game. I mean, this is a mass-produced item. An art collection gets, what, the cartridge, the code, the intellectual property?
I know it's very complicated. You know, I wasn't there on the acquisitions conversation. You know, part of acquisitions is deciding what, and then there's a process that goes behind it. But the museum worked with the original creators or with the publishers of the games to essentially acquire copies of the code and the right to display the games in public. There's obviously, you know, more legal, there's more of a legal framework. But, you know, the one of the exciting things is that this is new territory that's being explored by lots of different art forms. And anytime you take in something new, it raises a host of questions. So how do you take performance art or digital art? And, you know, Paola has been very forward in terms of acquiring things that maybe would be considered unorthodox into the collection already. So they've been accustomed to dealing with some of the gray areas and some of the new territory that's being explored in terms of the world of acquisition. But it is very exciting to see them kind of, you know, stake their claim and say, these are the games that we feel very passionately about and we'll do whatever it takes to make sure that the public can see them.
Jamin Warren is founder of Killscreen. It's a video game arts and culture magazine and website. You can learn more about MoMA's acquisition on the Word of Mouth Facebook page, where you can also answer the question, is Pac-Man art? Does MoMA's acquisition upgrade your ideas about games? And, of course, did they get the list right? Join the conversation taking place right now. That's on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio. We've looked at video games and the film industry, now to the quieter, declining world of books. 2012 brought the runaway success of the 50 Shades of Grey series, which Random House acknowledged with a $5,000 bonus to every single employee. Random House also figures into the other bookish highlight of the year. It's in the process of a merger with Penguin, combining two of the six biggest publishing houses worldwide. It's a shakeup that's likely to change the face of publishing, says Jason Bogue, editor of the publishing news website Gallicat. And it's a strategy that is likely to catch on.
There's even rumors of more mergers between other big six publishers. So I just think we're going to see a lot of conglomeration.
Jason also expects to see a lot more litigation in the coming year. In 2012, the Department of Justice sued five publishers for creating what they called the agency model, which guarantees that digital books cost the same price across all marketplaces. The DOJ declared the practice to be collusion. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder at a press conference in April.
Earlier today, we filed a lawsuit against Apple and five different book publishers: Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin, and Simon & Schuster.
So far, four of those publishers have settled, but Apple and Macmillan have decided they're going to go to court next year and fight the DOJ on this. So we're going to see a lot more litigation and a lot more arguments about what the future of both pricing and for business models for publishing.
So we asked Jason Bogue how legal battles will affect consumers in 2013, especially those readers who got e-readers like the Kindle, the Nook, or the iPad for holiday gifts.
For consumers, we're going to see lower e-book prices because the agency model that the DOJ said was unethical, that's gone now. So now places like Amazon or Barnes & Noble can discount e-books to make their prices more appealing to readers.
Aside from the business end, what will bookworms be enjoying in the new year?
2012 was the year of erotica and romance. It was a major explosion. It was going before 50 Shades of Grey. It's just that's when the media started to pay attention to it.
Looks like Mommy Porn, the sequel. Another up-and-coming trend, Jason predicts, the continued growth of new adult fiction, books aimed at late teens and young 20-somethings with stories about living on the cusp of adulthood. Winter is all about good books and great meals. So for more on what's coming up for food in 2013, we asked Maine chef and cookbook author Kathy Gunst, who cautions that watching for culinary trends is not an entirely objective undertaking.
Predicting food trends is not like fashion or film or the art world simply because it's so deeply personal. So my little black dress might be your fluorescent miniskirt.
First on Kathy's list of outgoing trends, kale?
Kale became the darling of many American kitchens.
Tender ribbons of kale in a lemony dressing tossed with bell pepper, pine nuts.
We all became convinced that this kind of rough, tough green leaf was going to cure everything. And while it is quite good for us and quite delicious, I think it's out.
And a trend that restaurant chefs embraced in 2012 is something called sous vide.
It's essentially taking food, whether it's meat or poultry or seafood and even vegetables, putting it into vacuum-sealed plastic and cooking it at a very, very low heat.
Kathy admits her hopes that the slow cooking method will die a rapid death in 2013 and adds a larger hope for the new year that cooks and diners shed the weight of what she calls food ignorance.
The idea that we can ignore what industrial agriculture is doing to our food world, the idea that it's okay to grow food in Peru and bring it here, the idea that it's okay to eat strawberries from halfway around the world in February.
So, Kathy's subjective predictions?
I predict that the idea of locally grown food will become more important than organic food. Two more quick things. Winter farmers markets are big. And I guess the last one I would say is I think we're going to see more gardens and homegrown and good food in our schools across the country. Many elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, they have huge programs that are reintroducing the idea that good food grown by children with the help of adults is going to be the future.
Kathy Gunst there, author of several cookbooks, most recently Notes from a Maine Kitchen. We also heard from Jason Bogue, editor of the publishing news website Gallicat, film consultant Garen Daly, and arts editor Clay Wirestone. Thank you, folks, for helping us set the table with some things to watch out for in 2013. And thank you for spending some of your new year with Word of Mouth. If you did miss any of the program or would like to share what you heard with a friend, wordofmouthradio.org has a full menu of past shows from our archives and easy links to post segments on social media or forward them to friends. I'm Virginia Prescott, wishing you all the best in 2013 and hoping to bring you plenty of new ideas to pass around through Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
All right.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent, Jonathan Lynch,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Ali Kosmikas
and Bill Barry.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
Actually, that sounds pretty good.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals.
And not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to our past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.
That's fancy, right?